Namaste. Good morning, everyone. Today, I would like to discuss two emails which I have received with very real situations. Very honest. And this is where this teaching plays a key role in daily living. The first question. I regularly attend your talks. I would like to share something with you. My son is 37 years old on the autism spectrum. A borderline case who is functional but a social misfit. In spite of attending your talks, reading books by you and Ramesh Balsekar, as well as imbibing the teachings, it sometimes becomes difficult to remain focused on the teaching and accept him for what he is. I would be grateful if you can give a talk on the acceptance of mental illness in the society, as many people do not come forward with the problems they face in such situations. So let's keep society out for the time being. This is a very real situation faced by any parent who has a child of special needs. It is truly a challenge. It is an immense challenge. Getting through each day sometimes is very challenging. One is the challenge within the home, and one is outside home. So my heart goes out to those who are facing such kind of challenges by the hand of destiny. Now, if we look at this in a very objective way, we are all human beings. This teaching does not make one into some saintly figure who will not react or who may not get triggered, let's say. We are all acting based on our genetics and conditioning. So a situation may arise where, in spite of being exposed to the teaching, having the understanding, let's say irritation may arise. It is natural. You see, what happens is the voice of the ego judges the reaction and says, I should not be this way. What does this mean? This means I have not imbibed the teaching. That is the judge which has stepped in again, which has some moralistic impression of how one should behave if one has understood the dynamics of duality. That is how the ego thrives and survives. By playing the judge, jury, and executioner. The man or woman of understanding in a given situation, let's say it is difficult to accept a situation with a child of special needs, and there's a reaction in the moment. The man of understanding knows that it happened because it was meant to happen. The man of understanding knows that nobody is truly a doer of their actions. neither the other, in which case it is the person with special needs, or myself as the parent, because neither of us chose this. So when the acceptance that neither of us is the doer of our actions, and therefore the acceptance that whatever happens is the will of God, the will of the source, the will of the divine, then one is not involved in that reaction, and one does not stretch it in the duration of time, blaming others or oneself. The involvement gets cut off with the understanding. This is what happens. This is a very real, so to speak, day-to-day living. Not an ideal of how things should be, how I should be so pious and pure and neutral in my reactions, etc., etc., etc. We are talking of today, here and now, not a goalpost in the future. This is the balm of the teaching. There is nobody to blame. There is nobody to condemn, neither the other or oneself. Now, this brings us to an important point. The point which is implied in this email, not mentioned in these specific words, is the difference between acceptance and surrender. Acceptance of the teaching, acceptance of a situation, acceptance of the will of God is one thing, and surrender is another dimension. When we are surrendered to what is in the moment, it means the total acceptance of what is in the moment, without, as I said, the judge judging what is and creating a story out of it. When surrender happens, not my will, O Lord, but thine be done, then all one's reactions, irritations, etc., are placed at the feet of God. It reminds me of what Joel Goldsmith had said in his early years. He had the full understanding. He even understood that one's so-called enemies, one should be praying for. If one gives up the belief in two powers, good and evil, and all there is consciousness, as he would say, the simplest is to pray for our friends. But if we truly had the deep understanding that the same consciousness functions through everyone, why wouldn't we pray for our enemies? So initially, he said to himself, he said, I've understood they are not the doers of their actions. I'm paraphrasing what I remember about reading about this point. He said, I accept them for who they are, and they did what they did. But he said, Lord, I am unable to love my enemies. I mean, it's asking for too much. I accept them. I accept what has happened as part of destiny, what is God's will, and all that. And he said, one day I just sat down and I said, it's so difficult to love one's enemies. And he said, the thought occurred, Lord, I may not be able to love my enemies, but you love them through me. And that is when surrender happened. You love them through me. I am unable to love them. Being honest. The biggest lie that can be said is, I surrender. The ego says, I surrender. If you catch yourself saying, I surrender, you haven't surrendered. Surrender happens when the ego which claims I surrender is absent. The next email. This is again a very real email written by someone with vast experience. So do pay close attention to this. I recently listened to part of your conversation with Rick Archer of Buddha at the Gas Pump. Your sincerity is refreshing. For me, it seems we give the I much more credence for our comfort. We say the I is constant and unchanging and thus real, whereas the relative world of differences and activities is changing and therefore not real. I'm bringing this up since I think you'll be honest about this. I think it's a panacea to say that what is real is not changing. I don't think it's honest to say this. So let me tell you, I am a physicist and have spent 47 years meditating. I would be dishonest if I said I don't identify with ego. I am a bit put off by the implication that the self is constant and the rest of the world is changing, and therefore don't worry if you suffer because it's a result of identifying with the changing aspect of life. And there's this unchanging aspect that we miss, and if we didn't miss it, we wouldn't suffer. It's easy to say and without merit for most people. So true. I'm only saying this since I feel you can appreciate the statement that I work my ass off to survive. And sometimes I do feel the constancy of being. Nonetheless, it gives me no comfort. As I said, I work my ass off to excel and survive. However, I give you credit where you refer to just abiding in being. But this being does not give me bliss or satisfaction. It just is. The lights will go out someday, and what is there to it all? Why do we construct the edifice of unchanging nature of being when it's as though we have to convince ourselves of that in order to minimize the suffering of life? Wouldn't we be better off being honest about it? I'm writing to you since I think you might understand this point and not say you just have to transcend to see this. I don't mean to be aggressive, but I hear so many people say this. Life is a change, and we might just be creating this constancy as a crutch to have some hope while we are facing the beast. My teacher Rameshji would have loved meeting this person at satsang, because he himself was so practical, daily living, facing the beast of daily living. You see, that is the beauty of satsang. The obvious and literal translation is the company of truth. Satsang. Sat, truth. Sang, company. As a Sufi master gave a most beautiful definition of satsang, he called it the quickening. The quickening, the fast track to the road home, leaving all your pretenses, all your masks behind that you are wearing with your friends, your colleagues, family, and for yourself. And when one comes to satsang with honesty, as both these two emails show, without the garb of pretense, that is when the possibility of an opening comes to light. Someone asked the same Sufi master, thinking perhaps she was asking a very intelligent question, or maybe out of irritation being in India and sitting with him. Why did God create flies? Was her question. And he said, what kind of a stupid question is that? Why don't you instead ask, why did God create you? Forget the flies, forget the others. That is satsang. So what this person has asked, a physicist on one side, meditating for 47 years on the other side, has asked the most basic of questions, most well said and well put, that it is all right when masters say about the unchanging nature of I, being, etc., etc., but we are faced with daily living. And therefore, the emphasis in this teaching is the criteria, which is peace of mind in daily living. Forget the unchanging I. Let's deal with situations as they arise in life, reflect on our reactions to the situation, and see if peace can be found through that situation. And we find that just a couple of concepts, when they are investigated and accepted, one is more at peace. Simple things that if we accept, we never know what the next moment brings. We accept that rather than wanting pleasure, 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 which will never happen. It's never been our experience. When we accept that the next moment is not in our control, sometimes pleasure, sometimes pain. That acceptance itself is the first step towards peace. Because then we are not running away from pain. Then we are open to walking through it, being guided through it. When we accept that our free will is not as precious as we thought it was. Why? Because we have no control over the outcome. We may intend something with our free will, but what happens is not in our control. More so, when we investigate and come to the conclusion that our free will, that free will which allows us to take decisions, is based on two factors, our genetics and our conditioning, over neither of which did we have any control, then we accept that free will is only a mechanism of functioning in daily living. We have to act as if we have free will, knowing that either way, it is the will of the source that prevails. When we accept that nobody is a doer of their actions, neither the other nor myself, because what we do is based on this set of genetics and conditioning which God created, then we don't blame, condemn, judge, and hate anyone, neither the other nor myself. Practical understanding. When all this acceptance seeps into our being, we find that our thinking mind, which was always operating in the imaginary future or the dead past, starts quietening down. And we are more at peace with what is. We are more at peace with the events that happen in our life. And we are more at peace with the people in our lives. And we are more at peace with ourselves. In other words, we are no longer being tossed around by events, people, and situations in our life like we used to be earlier, because the thinking mind has now quietened down. If there is nobody to hate, there is nobody to blame, there is nobody to condemn, the mind is a mind at peace. And that is abiding in being. Naturally, it naturally happens that one is available for the next moment and the next and the next. Witnessing the flow of life, whatever happens, becomes a way of being, which is the unchanging I. The ego still has to operate in daily living. The ego, with its baggage of conditioning, has to operate. And some egos are gifted with spiritual guidance, wisdom, etc., which becomes their fresh conditioning. A new way they can see the same situations in life. A new way they can see the same people in their lives. That is when transformation happens. Transformation. The forms, which are the same, have been transformed. The result is peace of mind. Now, if we flip this around, what is the point in trying to focus and meditate on the unchanging I, etc., etc., and your daily living is a mess? You're fighting with the same people you fight with all the time, whether family or friends. You're judging the same people you judge all the time. You're condemning the same people. You're blaming the government. You're blaming this one. You're hating that one. But rest of the time, you're trying to abide in the unchanging I. There's a complete split then. It is not a holistic way of being. It may be sincere and earnest because the focus is on the unchanging, but peace is to be found through daily living. And as Bhagwan Ramana Maharshi said, the state of equanimity is the state of bliss. The state of equanimity. Equanimity where? Not only in meditation, equanimity in daily living. Are we going to constantly brush under the carpet all our deeper feelings, thoughts, emotions, so we don't have to look at them? And the dust keeps building up and up and up. Or an opportunity comes, a teaching comes, something one reads, one hears, and says, hey, you know, how much of this dust are you going to accumulate? Why not? Just turn the carpet a bit. Look at it. Know that it is there. Understand it. See it for what it is. What is life about? Why am I being faced with these situations? What is there to learn? Sat Sang. You're facing the truth now. Most beautiful question. As he says, we are facing the beast till the lights go out. Might as well give a chance to living a life of peace and harmony till the lights go out. Someone sent me a mail saying that I'm suffering from migraine headaches for the last 6 months. I can't sleep at night. Why is God doing this to me? Why don't we ask, why did God give me nights of beautiful sleep for all these years? Is it our right? And when something goes wrong, we blame God. He did this to me. Doership as a concept is so entrenched in us. The first question reminds me of when irritation arose. It was with my mother, who's a bit hard of hearing. So I found I had to repeat myself 2 or 3 times. So I just kept quiet because I didn't want to repeat myself anymore. And she was wanting to know what I was saying. So I told her, I said, Mom, if I talk in a loud voice, it's too much doership. It's a strain on the vocal cords. And she laughed, and even I had a laugh. You see, it happens. It's just that when this functioning is seen in the light of impersonality, there's nobody to blame. There's nobody to judge. In Maharaj, irritation would arise. Someone once asked him, seeing him smoking his bidi, Maharaj, you seem to be addicted to smoking. And immediately came the reply in his, with a stern look. And he said, you seem to be addicted to not smoking. That's it. Why did God create flies? I remember once outside after Rameshji's satsang, we went to the chai shop. Everything is a matter of perspective. And you know, you're ordering a idli dosa, whatever, and chai. So one Westerner, very sweet lady, was in front of me. And there were a lot of flies around because it was an open air restaurant. No air conditioning and all that. There were flies around the table and it was a job to keep them off. The waiter would come with his duster and do like this. And so I saw she was enjoying her meal and then she took a slice of her idli, put some sambar on it and whatever chutney, this, that, and took it out of her plate and put it maybe 10 inches away on the table. And I thought, And I told her, I said, this is really the Buddha's compassion that you're even keeping food aside for the flies. She said, what nonsense. I've kept it there so that they go there and don't disturb my plate. Practical. Right. If anyone would like to share anything or ask questions, they can do so now. And please keep your camera on, because that's more for security reasons, so we don't get these. I think my team refers to them as bots, or I don't know, unwanted elements. So that's a request. I wanted to add one point here, keeping in mind the second letter. You see, what happens in life? I'm going to ring just now these symbols. So there's going to be silence before, then you will hear the sound. And when the sound fades, there's again silence. So let's look at this. This is very simple. It's not something I'm seeing that special. As past, present, and future. We are, of course, looking at it from a distance. So let's just hypothetically call the silence before the sound as the past. Let's call the sound when it happens as the present. And let's call the silence after the sound as the future. Now, the sound could be an event in your life. Something has happened. So what takes place is we split our life into what happened before the event, and what is there after the event. We have sliced it like that. Now, when we go through all three right now, when I ring the symbols, the realization happens that the silence does not go anywhere when the sound is there. It is the bedrock of being. So, in the silence, the sound emerges, is heard, and dissipates back into the silence. But even while the sound is there, the substratum is the same. Just like words emerge from silence, from the source, what happens? Thoughts form, thoughts take the shape of words, and words get delivered as speech. And when the speech is over, there's again no sound. So in life, one finds that with witnessing the flow of life, this bedrock of being, while earlier it appeared, it disappeared because my peace of mind was so disturbed when the event happened. Where did it go? One realizes that that is always there. It is the mind, the thinking mind, which is vacillating. And with that, knowing that that bedrock of silence and peace is always ever present, one, so to speak, taps into that even while the turmoil is going on. So I'm going to ring this now. All right. Yes, Kumar.
Namaste, Gautam, sir. So Namaste. I had a daily life question. So one of my neighbor's daughters tried to commit suicide, and she was just very young. So she came up to me that I should spend some time with her and, you know, try to meditate with her and talk with her. So I did so for like 20 days. And by the end of it, I started feeling drained and mentally exhausted. So how to not take up stuff from others, like when somebody shares their suffering and how to get stay unaffected and not get drained yourself.
Yes, that is a very nice question you have asked, Kovan, because it, you know, this is what happens when we are whatever is in our environment and our conditioning is imbibed by us. In your case, this is exactly what has happened, you see. And it can be draining because I have heard of cases where, let's say there's a couple, you know, and one person is depressed. One of the two is depressed. The other person who was not depressed falls into that cycle, whether you call it association, whether you call it empathy. So the only way out, so to speak, is if one is anchored in being and does not get lost in the story. And this is very important because, you know, I have seen this as a big pitfall. I know yoga teachers who think that they can guide people on the path. Yoga is yoga. But, you know, it's an earnest need to help others, to want to make them happy. But are we ourselves happy? Are we anchored in being and are we at peace? Because if we are not, then it just becomes a game of projection. So if Kuvar feels that I am not the doer, nor is the other, and if Kuvar is anchored in being, then the draining will not happen, because who is it that is drained? It is the ego with its sense of doership that is drained. Being, pure being, cannot be drained. And that is why, Kuvar, one of the best things to do in such situations is to just listen. Because when we just listen and we allow the other person to express themselves, say what they want, we are not bringing in our concepts into the equation. We are allowing what has to be expressed as the divine will to be expressed. And then if something arises, let's say we feel like saying something, that is not coming from the space of doership, that I know better. I have seen this because I have friends who are therapists, yoga teachers and all. And they confess this point, you know, that in situations where they don't have this experience, they are being made to say something. And out of that compulsion that since the person has come to me, I must say something, you know, that can derail a process even further. So, firstly, if one is at peace oneself, one is abiding in being, one is handling life situations in a calm and equanimous way, then one has something to contribute to such a situation. By all means, and especially if someone asks, if what happens is people ask, and some people don't ask, yet we give free advice. My teacher was very much against that, because he said to give free advice means we think we know better than God. You see? So, firstly, let's say you have the understanding, you're abiding in being, and you are still feeling drained. The best thing to do is to stay away for some time, till you gather your energies, so to speak, till you feel more grounded, more anchored, and operate from that space of being. You see? And if you do feel that you're getting pulled into this drama, then the best option is to recommend a qualified therapist to the person and to step away with the best of intentions. So you have to see what works best for you in this situation. Does that answer your question?
That was very, very helpful. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yes, Vandana.
Hello, Gautam.
Hello.
I have two questions. One is that all of us as human beings are seeking peace of mind. What happens to atheists who are not anchored in being? How do they seek their peace of mind? Because they don't believe in any concept. Secondly, if we believe in this non-doership and of having or hardly having any free will, is it promoting irresponsible behavior?
Vandana, firstly, as Rameshji would say, an atheist cannot be an atheist unless it was the will of God. You see, you may be an atheist or not, but what, as you just now said, everyone wants most is peace of mind. So forget whether a person is an atheist or not. It is irrelevant. At least we know that the person wants peace of mind, and that is where we begin. Isn't it? One could say that everyone wants peace of mind. So forget God. Rameshji would say, forget the word God. Let's use the word source. Let's use the word consciousness, whatever doesn't. Because even the atheist is coming from a conditioned belief of what the word God is. He doesn't like it that there's a higher power which is in charge and control. So the person becomes an atheist as per the will of God. So we don't use that word if there's too much baggage associated with it. But the fact is, you have to live your life day in and day out. Is it going to be a life lived in peace and equanimity? Or is it going to be a life when not only are you suffering, but creating immense suffering from others? And that is why the Sufi masters say that this definition of ahimsa is most misunderstood as non-violence. Because true ahimsa means not hurting the feelings of others. Forget physical violence. Not hurting the feelings of others is true ahimsa. And that can happen when one is living the teaching. When one sees that if it's the same electricity functioning through everyone, would one really want to hurt another person or harm another person? That would not even arise. It may happen unintentionally. Hurt may happen because after all, I may say something which is misunderstood, misinterpreted, and an apology may arise. But there is equanimity because deep down we have accepted that it is the same consciousness functioning through everyone. That is called living the life of ahimsa. And the ego's immediate defense is that if there is no free will, then does it mean I'm not responsible for my actions? That is the first thing which comes up, which used to come up in Rameshji's satsangs. And he said that it has been misunderstood what I said. Because let's take a case where someone is a gentle and timid person. Is he going to, if I give him a machine gun, is he going to pick it up and shoot people and say, oh, I'm not responsible for my actions? No, it is not in his nature. The teaching is pointing at something very basic. That, look here, your breath is not in your control. The blood flowing through your veins is not in your control. It can be stopped like this. The next moment and what it brings, its challenges or its pleasures, is not in your control. The earth which is spinning beneath your feet is not in your control. So this free will that has been placed on a pedestal by you, it's really not that grand, because I, as the Almighty, am behind all this. So this obsession with me and my free will starts diminishing. This is not about this responsibility falling away. That is a secondary aspect. This weight we are carrying on our shoulders, I did this, I was responsible for this. You know, it's seen in a true light. And then when it is seen in that light, life becomes very humbling. That there's so much when I think I did, there's so much I didn't do. Rather, it was done to me. That becomes the perspective. And when it comes to responsibility, I do what I think and I feel I should do as a responsible person or a responsible citizen or whatever it is. But thereafter, I lay my baggage down. My fight is over. So I still operate, I still function the way I have been created. And I see that everybody functions the way they have been created. Everyone will be responsible for the consequences of their actions. They are not going to be absolved of it. If I commit a crime, Society is there and laws are there to take charge of the situation. So I'm not absolved of the consequences. But my peace is to be found in the fact that I can see this vast, majestic force of God operating in life's situations and through the people I meet. I see how it is all so beautifully interconnected and how so much is just happening by the divine will that I can rest in that peace that I do what I think and feel I should do in a given situation and leave the rest to Him.
So when we, supposing I react or respond to a situation, what it means is that I should not carry the baggage of that and keep analyzing that, except to introspect that maybe I should not react in the similar manner when a situation arises next.
Exactly. That's all that Vandana can do. We can't help being triggered. All of us get triggered by certain people in our lives, let's say. But what happens before the teaching and after the teaching? Now Vandana knows. Now I've understood that this person is really not doing it in that sense. They've been conditioned that way, and I've been conditioned that this particular button should be pushed. So that personal finger pointing and blaming is now dissolved as far as Vandana and this person is concerned. But Vandana carries years of conditioning and is going to react when the button is pushed. But she is no longer involved in it for days and days thinking this should not have happened. Why did he do this? Why did I say this? That involvement in the drama of life, Vandana finds, is reducing. It doesn't mean that her buttons will no longer get pushed. But the force with which the button has been pushed has lesser and lesser and lesser impact on Vandana. You see? So it is not, as I said earlier, a life of perfection one is aiming for. We are human beings having a human experience. We are all built a certain way. But we are no longer invested in our reactions like we used to be.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Yes, Poonam.
Hello, Gautam. Thank
Hello.
You for everything.
Thanks.
So I was just, I just had this thought. So I wanted to share with you, like, isn't it like when we are always stationed in the being, we are just watching the play of consciousness. Like we are just watching what consciousness is doing, what we are doing, but we are watching the consciousness doing it through our body, right? Isn't it like that? And then there's no fear of anything. Like when some suffering comes or some disease comes or anything comes, it's like we are watching God facing all that through the body mind.
Yes, that is very nicely said. But Poonam, I can add here that even if there is fear, even that is witnessed.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, even the fear is witnessed. But isn't it like the second email that you read, I was just getting this thing in my mind that isn't it like kind of a humor where we watch God going through everything. And when we know that it's not me, it's God who's saying, it's God who's suffering, it's God who's doing, and like we are just the ones who are just stationed in the being and seeing the whole play of consciousness. Even when you're talking to somebody and interacting with maybe people whom you like or you don't like or whatever, it's still God who's doing the whole thing.
Yeah.
So isn't it like a pleasure to see God doing everything through this body mind?
Yeah, and but more importantly, that's actually a beautiful way to live life. But it is God seeing all this, not Poonam as the ego seeing all this happening.
Right.
See, that
right.
is the main
that's
point.
That's why I wanted to share with you so that I don't get my ego in middle somewhere. So I wanted to share with you because I didn't want the ego again to come there. So
it is not
that's why I wanted to share it with you.
Witnessing all this and witnessing God. It is God witnessing God.
God witnessing God. Yeah. God witnessing God. But then there's no fear left, Gautam, in life, because if some disease happens to this body mind, it's not you whom the disease has happened to. It has happened to the whoever is living the life, I mean, God
very
consciousness
true,
who's living.
Very true, very true. Yet, there could be fear because fear is of different kinds and degrees. So,
yeah.
for example,
yeah.
if I have the full understanding, I could still fear a painful death, let's say. I don't have the fear of death. I have the fear of a painful death. Who would want a painful death, right?
Right.
So whatever, if no fear arises, fantastic. And if it arises, it is not judged. It is witnessed. And fear could be not what someone would normally fear. Like people fear just the thought of death. I can't even think that I'm going to die. And someone may be comfortable with the thought of death and is happy to, as Rameshji would say, death is nothing but a long, deep sleep. But that person may fear a painful death. So we don't know. None of it is judged. It is all witnessed on the screen of being.
Right. I just wanted to share with you because I just felt that, isn't it God living through this body mind and we are just watching him facing everything, even challenges that we get, so many challenges in life. And we do get sometimes thrown into the identity and then again we say, oh my God, it's not me, it's him who's living it.
That's true. And that is why Rameshji would say, you know, when there are problems in life, tell God, you created the problem, you deal with it.
Right. And actually, it's also trust. Yeah, the trust also comes there, no, Gautam, sometimes, because that moment when you really have to trust that it's his life and let him do whatever he wants. Why are you getting your ego in middle?
Yeah, but as Rameshji would say, trust in God, but lock your car.
Yeah.
Do what you think and feel you should do, because you have to operate in daily living.
Right. Thank you.
That was beautiful.
Thank you, Gautam.
Yes, Pavan.
Gautam, sir, can you hear me?
Yes.
How are you, Gautam, sir?
Good, good. Pavan, can you try not shaking your camera, because then the voice will come out clearly.
Sure. Gautam, sir, my question is, you know, what can one do to let the teaching further flow from an intellectual level into your daily living? I likely know the answer is you cannot do anything.
Right.
I think I'm expecting to hear that. But beyond that, you know, from a trying perspective, you know, especially when you listen into satsangs, you kind of get a feeling that you pretty much understand most of it. But when it comes to real life, you see yourself fail over and over again, especially when it comes to blaming others or the sense of doership is concerned. You realize you're such a failure, in terms of realizing that the teaching is only at an intellectual level. I know we cannot do anything because it's all God's will, but is there still anything that could be tried as far as, you know, man trying to do something about it?
Yeah, Pavan, absolutely a very good question you have asked. And you see, I don't understand what you mean by failure. For example, let's say I blame someone, I still blame someone like I used to earlier. But even the intellectual understanding is there now, even after the event has happened, that, oh God, you know, it looks so senseless. I blamed someone for something. And now I understand, although just intellectually, that they are not the doers. Doesn't that itself create a shift compared with when you are not exposed to the teaching?
I see where you're coming from. Yeah.
You see, so that itself is the teaching in operation. So while Pavan may still feel he failed because he judged someone or blamed someone, Pavan must realize that that is based on years and years of conditioning. And what this teaching does, it's like a hammer, because it has to hammer away at the old conditioning. It's going to take time. But Pavan should still not discount the intellectual understanding, because earlier he blamed people. Now he still blames people and he feels, what has happened? The teaching has done nothing. But at least now, after the event of blame, Pavan looks back and says, in light of the teaching, hey, you know, actually, what happened? Now I can see that this person was not really doing it. to me as an individual. It's the way they were made. And in the light of intellectual understanding, in hindsight, Pawan realizes that, oh God, I actually blamed him. But still, that involvement in the blame is finished with the intellectual understanding. So there is a difference between Pawan before being exposed to the teaching and after. It is just that Pawan wants the understanding to be so total that the blame should not arise. And that is how the ego functions. It wants things a certain way. And that is why we say, let the teaching do its job. It is already doing it, Pawan. Otherwise, you would not be here talking to me. You see, if the teaching had no impact on you, you would not be here. There are thousands and thousands who are not here. So it has obviously had some impact at some level. And that has to be allowed to do its job without the ego trying to speed up the process. Because the ego wants deliverance fast. I should be at perfect peace with what happens at life. It's again a very sincere thought to have, but it is not in the ego's control. But during this time, what can Pawan do? When he faces situations every day with what happens to him or the people or life situations, he can reflect on it in the light of the teaching. By all means, that can be done. And you see certain things. You can see your own patterns. You can see others' patterns. And it is that witnessing which creates the transformation, which earlier was not happening. Earlier, Pawan was lost in the drama of life. Now, he may still be lost in the drama of life, but there's this awareness that, hey, there's a new way to look at this situation. Maybe it didn't strike me in the moment because I just reacted based on my patterning and conditioning. Now I look at it. So this constant remembrance, reflection, creates that opening, creates that space. And the teaching is bound to do its job. As Rameshji would say,
thank you so
if
much.
The teaching has brought you so far, if God has brought you so far, why do you think he will drop you here? He is going to take you home. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you. Thank you. Yes, Abhishek.
Hello, Gautam sir. How are you?
Hello, I'm good. How are you?
Good, Gautam sir. I just wanted to share one line. Which came to my mind when I was reading Kaur Tole book. So the moment you know you are not aware, you are aware.
Absolutely.
So that's how I compare myself when I was not aware of the teaching. And while I still make mistakes out of my unconscious behavior, but still I immediately realize that I was not aware while doing that. But it makes me aware that time itself.
That's it.
Yesterday something happened and I unconsciously said one line to someone. And then again, after just 1 second, I realized that it was out of my unconscious behavior. By not being aware, I said few things. But the next moment, I found myself aware. So I think that's a good pointer that teaching is taking place.
Yes, very well said.
Yes, earlier I was not aware of not being aware.
Yeah, and also more importantly, Abhishek will not blame himself for not being aware.
I did for just 1 second, I would be aware. But then I know that was my ego that again was living itself.
Yeah, that's so funny, isn't it?
Yes, and I want to share one more thing. How in a subtle manner ego plays role. So I have a habit of getting up early in the morning. And I generally get up at generally 5 in the morning. And I always say that I get up in the morning. But it's been a week. I'm not able to get up before 8 or 9 a.m. Then I realized that was actually not in my hand. That was my subtle way of ego playing the role that I was getting up in the morning. So now it's been a week that it happened that I was not getting, you know. So the thing is that ego plays role very in a subtle manner as well.
Yeah, because you know, if the ego had its way, it would claim that I am going into deep sleep. Can anyone force deep sleep upon them? They can't. That is one's life experience. That's so
really waking up as well.
Ego's control, that even your deep sleep is not in the ego's control. It happens.
It happens, actually. So I realized that even waking up happened.
Crazy. So
I think these small things are taking place, like, you know, looks to me that I'm getting aware.
Yeah, that's nice.
And Gautam sir, just could you please highlight a bit upon, like, I was reading about Ramana Maharshi's teachings as well, and he said that you should contemplate who am I always.
Yes.
So for example, what I have learned from that is it right or not. So see, if a thought arises, so then we need to contemplate to whom that thought arises, right?
Yes.
So that thought arises to the mind, but whose mind is it?
Yes.
It's a consciousness mind, right?
Yes.
So that means the ultimate, the true thought is I, which is I am the consciousness.
Yes.
So every time, whenever a thought arises, you have to trace back to it that I am the consciousness, right?
Yes. Right? Also, Abhishek, the thing is you will not get an answer, because who am I is not a question which can be answered. Because the minute you regress into the step before, that who is it to whom the thought is arising, if you get that answer, there'll yet be another step of regression to regress back into the I. You see, because it is, there is no answer to who am I. It is the ego which is looking for the answer. And we can go into this self-investigation, self-inquiry of Ramana Maharshi at another talk. I can elaborate my understanding of it and see if it resonates or not.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, we'll take one last question for today. Yes, Shabnam. Shabnam, are you there?
Yeah.
Yes, hello.
Hello. Hi.
Hi, hi. That's Shabnam's son, right?
Was it right? Siddharth.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, thank you again. So, I'll just take up a little bit from where you were explaining Vandana, and then, you know, taking off from where Pavan left. So basically, yes, I am with your answer to her, wherein the gap has decreased, you know, like earlier how I was and now where I am. So earlier maybe I would dwell on something for a very long time. So now the gap is decreasing and I'm trying to abide more with the learning of the past conditioning have been, you know, pretty long. So therefore, it's, I don't know, it's difficult to kind of eliminate it. And the unrest comes from where Pavan left was that, you know, and your answer was reassuring that if God has brought you to this point, he'll take you there as well. But I sometimes fear that, you know, what if nothing happens? I mean, like, what if one pops off, you know, before that time?
Then there's no problem at all. That's the end to Shabnam's troubles and stories.
True, that's also there, but you know, one would, I mean, I don't know, I'm feeling more impatient there that, you know what, I mean, this entire life I'd be only listening to satsang and not abiding by the teacher, or it's not going to happen in this lifetime. What is it?
No, but would you say that by and large, today, let's say there was a quotient of peace. Is it different from what you were 10 years ago, 5 years ago? Do you sense any difference or not really?
No, tremendous, tremendous difference. I do see a lot of difference in understanding, of course, but then another 10 years, so you know what I mean? It's like,
you know what, there's this...
Before the sound and after the sound. So, you know, the period, I don't know how long that's going to be.
I think you have to turn it around to an expression of gratitude. There was a lady who was with this very hardcore Sufi master. And it was really a path of suffering. She suffered the training, so to speak. And she was in her early 50s. And after a year or two, she told him, like, you know, I mean, I'm beaten to the bone and it's too tough. This path is too difficult. And he said, don't worry, I think in about 15, 16 years, you'll be done. And she said, what? And he said, why? But see what you were 2 years ago compared to where you are now. Isn't that a big progress? She said, certainly, I almost feel a different person. So he said, just drop this notion of time. That how much more time, how many years, deal with each day as it comes and as it presents itself to you. Forget the comparing and judging, which is what the ego does. I want things faster. I want things to be a certain way. I want the understanding all the time. I want to be a paragon of peace. Forget it. Leave room for mistakes. Leave room for imperfection. Allow them to be. Embrace them, knowing that you didn't create them. Let it be. Let the teaching do its job. Rather than taking on this burden in the mind that, you know, I want it faster and losing the peace of the day and of the moment, just relax and let it all be the way it is. And you will find that over time, just like what perhaps happened with you, I don't know when you were exposed to this teaching, but you will find that, you know, you have changed. Others will find you have changed. You will find maybe certain relationships you're getting triggered the same way, other relationships you're not. It's a very fluid thing. Just allow that to flow. We have to be gentle on ourselves. Because, you know, right from childhood, when our parents told us, do this, don't do this, be obedient, be this way, be that way, we start telling ourselves, be this way, be that way, don't think these thoughts. That is how we have been conditioned, you know. And here is the source consciousness, which tells you, hey, look, take it easy, man, you know, chill out. See life in this new light. See it as a play of consciousness. See your own reactions, your own faults, which you call your faults, that I gifted them to you as the source, and just take it easy. So don't be hard on yourself. Okay?
Sorry. Shall I say something more?
Sure, but I think you have to talk a bit louder because the voice is a bit dim.
Okay, I'll try.
Yeah.
I don't know whether it's the camera, I mean, the sound. Or what. So my, the second thing that was coming, I mean, the thing that comes to my mind is that sometimes I find myself looting because of my reactions. You know, like if it is in anger, especially in anger, and, you know, there is anger inside, which is also being subdued and suddenly kind of erupts. So I just can't forgive myself for that sometimes. I mean, the situation is such that I question that how much have I learned and how much more I have to learn. You know, that's what happens. So it's basically dealing with anger that kind of gets me derailed, I would say.
Sure, not just you, many people. Many people get derailed when it comes to anger. And I don't think we have time today to go into this in detail. But you see, Shabnam, everyone is prone to certain reactions. And when we look honestly at anger, you know, and what anger actually truly means deep down, there are various ways to look at this. But basically, it's very subtle, but being angry is because we don't like things the way they are and we blame people and ourselves. We have this ideal of how things should be, and so anger arises. You see, and anger is a destructive emotion. There's no doubt about it. You see, but the one who is getting consumed in the emotion of the anger is the one in whom it is arising. You see, and then when we investigate anger deeply, which we will do in another talk, we can expose anger to see what it truly is. And what has happened is that the ego has got invested in this energy called anger. And when it has attributed it to circumstances and people on which it thrives, I am angry. When this part of it is exposed, anger is seen just as a very pure movement of energy without a me invested in the anger. So I don't want to elaborate now because we don't have the time, but we can go into this topic of anger for sure. And perhaps it will give you some insights. But having said that, you see, a teaching will not just work in some aspects of life and not in others. It is going to work in totality. So don't be afraid that, you know, I've understood parts of the teaching and certain aspects of me have changed and this has not. It is not a teaching which operates in compartments, because the teaching is the annihilation of the ego as the doer. It is the annihilation of the thinking mind in totality. So while it may appear that it's working in parts and not working in parts, that is the mind creating that story. This teaching is going to transform some aspects gradually, some aspects faster, depending on each one's individual makeup and conditioning. But nothing will be left out. That is the gift of this teaching. All right? Okay. We'll just sit for a couple of minutes in silence. I've changed the view so I can see all of y'all. I have a friend in whom anger rises. He's probably in his late 60s now. And he says, when I get angry with God, I pull down my pants and show him my bum. And then I abuse him. And after that, I'm at peace. Out of the system, you see. The thing is, we hold on to this thing and create suffering. What a fantastic relationship with God. There's a beautiful practice, kind of what Joel Goldsmith had said, that when you meet someone, let's say if you meet someone today or tomorrow, just pause for a moment, and before labeling that person with his name and the form, let that thought arise. Consciousness is meeting consciousness. Let it be intellectual. Let the thought arise that now, whatever this person is going to say is based on his genetics and conditioning, which I will be available for, because I will no longer be too quick to judge or give my opinion. And you will find that you become more and more available for the other, which means more and more present. Thank you.